Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And I would say, Rabbit, that we have what I would describe as a meaty program today.
We do. We do indeed. We have meat and where it comes from, meat and how you cut it up and how you sharpen the things you cut it up with. And then to finish off, one of America's great food writers writing a whole book about the pig, and it's part of Southern American cuisine. So it's a fascinating program for you. And we're starting out today with something really, which turned out to be a very unusual interview with a company based in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which is big in the veal business. And if you ever thought, well, I don't eat veal because of all kinds of ethical concerns and all things like that, and besides it's not very interesting, I think that Strauss Brand's veal will change your mind, and I think you'll be very interested by what the spokesperson had to say.
This is Randy Strauss.
Randy Strauss, is veal itself making a big comeback?
Well, I think that what we're trying to accomplish here at Strauss Brands is reintroducing veal so people know that there's a product they can feel good about. We have two programs that we've been working very hard on.
Yeah, let's specify that it is a business called
Strauss Brands.
Okay.
And we're located in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We were founded in 1937 by my grandfather. And
it's still a family-run business.
Family-run. My brother and myself run it. Best friends live next door to each other and share the same passion for making a positive impact for our animals.
Okay, so tell us now about your product.
Well, we have two product lines. We have a pasture raise, which is called our free raise program. That's authentic pasture raised veal raised on the pasture alongside the mother in herd. These calves get nothing but mother's milk, a little bit of pasture grass. We're proud of our 9 label claims, some of them no hormones, no antibiotics, raised in the pasture alongside mother and herd.
Oh, it's a wonderful list.
Agriculturally sustainable. We're very proud of all those label claims, but the product speaks for itself. It's absolutely fantastic. It's delicious. It cooks beautifully, and it's nutritionally fabulous for you. In other words, it's lower in fat than a boneless, skinless chicken breast, if you can believe that.
Now, where do you do this, Randy? I mean, do you actually own the farms, or do you buy them?
We have relationships with several hundred ranchers. This is our pasture raised program. I mentioned there's two programs. So the pasture raised program, we work with farmers and ranchers around the United States. We seasonally follow the green grass. The mother cows need grass in order to produce rich and healthy milk. The calves primarily, you know, drink that milk, and that's what makes them such, you know, delicious tasting product.
Okay.
Our other product, though, Peter, is group raised veal. Now, group raised veal pretty much is group calves raised in a more group environment, not how people possibly perceive veal being raised, but this is raised by, again, family farmers. It's a dairy byproduct. These are Holstein calves. And they eat a whey protein, which is a byproduct of the cheese industry, but that's primarily what they eat, and that's called special fed veal.
You know, this is when my great uncle had a dairy farm in Ohio, and I remember feeling so sad about these calves because they were taken from their mothers and put in a pen.
Well, they have to go somewhere. I mean, it's farming's a business after all.
Well, the reality of that, and you're bringing up a very valid point, and that is that the veal industry was derived from the dairy industry. For a cow to give milk, it has to have a calf every year.
Oh, yeah.
The females go back into herd replacement to make milk, and the males didn't really have anywhere to go, and the veal industry came along and took the surplus whey protein from the cheese industry and created a special fed calf. It's wonderful, and, you know, one of the misperceptions of veal is that, you know, it's such a young, you know, protein, but the truth is it's about the third oldest protein, 3 times older than chicken, and, you know, people sometimes, because of the animal welfare movements, perceive a veal calf to be something, you know, very small, but this is, you know, a 500-pound, fairly mature animal.
Okay, so these are not real baby white veal of the kind that the French in particular really love. They're animals that, first of all, they always run around, or they have the opportunity to walk and run around.
Well, again, we're kind of, you know, mixing up two programs, but our pasture-raised programs out in the pasture, never see a barn. The only, you know, confinement is the stars above. I mean, these are truly pasture-raised animals. Our group-raised calves are raised in more of a barn facility.
Oh, okay. So they're more indoors.
Right.
Okay.
And they're like, you know, 16, they're about 20 to 22 and a half, 23 weeks old, and they're, you know, roughly 450 to 500 pound animals.
Because you get mixed up with your programs, I mean, don't your customers get mixed up with your...
Well, I think there's two different distinct type of customers. There's those that, you know, have been used to, you know, the veal that's been served in this country for the past 40 years. That's what, you know, you were mentioning, Peter, about that white milk fed or the white veal that we all think of now. What we're accomplishing and what we're trying to, you know, retrain chefs and consumers alike to understand is that it's okay for veal to be pinker in color. Pinker in color is a healthier product.
Okay, so you would class your product in both cases as pink veal.
Pinker, right, because white veal, typically we deprive the calf of iron, and that's what, you know, keeps that calf to have that whiter color to it. But pinker actually, you know, has a little bit of flavor, and, you know, it's just as tender, and it's better for you, and it's better for the calves, because the calf grows more naturally.
Now, what's the crossover between veal and young beef?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know if I'd be the best person to answer that. I think that once young beef, you know, would go more into a, you know, some sort of a finishing process where our calves are weaned off them. You know, when the mother, you know, moves on, our calves are, you know, brought in for processing.
Now, the reason I asked the question is we were in the region of Italy called Le Marche, and they pride themselves on young beef called Marchigiana beef. And I don't know exactly how old it is, but it's beyond 23 weeks, but probably not yet a year old. And it's something that, you know, is a non-traditional in my native land, non-traditional here, but the Marchigiani people absolutely love it.
Right, and you know what? This thing, in many ways, there's similarities, but the truth is our pasture-raised program is still veal. And, you know, it's wonderful because it actually has a little bit of flavor. Some of the loin chops and the rib chops, there's a little bit of a distinction. Once you go into the beef, there's a more beefy flavor. This is still a milk-fed. This is truly authentic veal, the way veal was raised for centuries. I mean, the fatted calf in the Bible was raised the same way, and we're really proud to bring back that authentic veal. In the 1940s, when people were eating veal, they were eating 8.4 pounds per person, you know, a year, and today they're eating less than a half a pound. So
what
we're just trying to recreate that.
Yeah, what started this big scare off, and when did it start?
I think in the late 80s and early 90s, the animal welfare movements became very vocal. They chose veal as the poster child for creating their message that, you know, there were problems in agriculture. And veal calf is in some, they showcased a very small baby veal calf, and they created a lot of awareness around it. And that's what kind of caused people to start rethinking their choices.
So now you have a really uphill educational struggle to market your product now?
Well, we do, and we've been really fortunate because it's gotten a lot of fantastic national and international recognition. You know, we were on the Oprah Winfrey Show and Fox and Friends and a lot of different New York Times, Wall Street Journal. We're proud to be on your show, Ann and Peter, and getting the message out there so people can feel good about eating veal again. Chefs can put on the menu, feel assured that the veal they're serving, their guests will appreciate and enjoy, and know that the calves were raised with the utmost respect.
How did you get to this philosophy?
That's a great question, and the truth is that about 15 years ago, probably 12 to 15 years ago, my wife started going down this healthy and organic path, and this was even before Whole Foods was in our neighborhood, and we just started caring about what we ate. You know, we had drink, we never gave our children antibiotics, and we're living this fantastic, healthy, you know, and wholesome, organic lifestyle at home. And we said, how can we make our business better? How can we translate our personal family's philosophies into our business that, you know, certainly has gone through some rough times? And we want to make a positive and meaningful impact on animal welfare. We're not stopping here with veal. You know, we're going to go into free-raised pork and free-raised beef and free-raised lamb. And free-raise will be the trademark. That will be the absolute gold standard for animal welfare.
Now, you said this business has existed for quite a long time.
Right.
Was it always in the same business, or was this a sort of a new venture?
No, you know what, Peter? We've always been, you know, in the veal business.
Okay.
We've been on and off with lamb. About 10 years ago, we purchased a lamb company, and we started getting more heavily invested in lamb. And I would say we're probably 60-40 lamb and veal now. But we are moving into those other proteins, you know, all under the same, these healthy label claims, with making sure that everything is the best it can possibly be for the animals, the environment, and for the people that are eating it.
Now, the product is really excellent, and it's very, very carefully packed and just arrives in just absolutely perfect condition. I mean, that's something we should stress. I don't think I've ever had a more regular piece of veal shank to make osso buco. I mean, with a place you can actually get to the marrow from both sides,
rather than being cut off
in the wrong place.
And we are a large packer. I mean, we're one of the largest veal packers in the United States, but we're the only ones that are doing pasture-raised, our free-raised program. We're the only ones to be 100% group-raised and tether-free. That means these calves never have any sort of tether, and they're raised constantly in groups for constant socialization. But, you know, bringing back to your point, yes, we are very good at, you know, cutting, and we have a very, you know, custom-cut shop here, so the osso buco would all be, you know, if you want center cut, you get center cut. If you want 12-ounce, you get 12-ounce. Anything a customer could possibly want, we have available.
Now, how do they get this? That's the next most important thing. How do people lay their hands on, first of all, the range of product that you have, and then how do they get it delivered to them?
Well, if you're talking about consumers, Allen Brothers is our partner of ours, and their catalog is beautiful, and they do a fantastic job, and it's just magnificent.
AllenBrothers.com. Okay.
There's some other sites that, you know, carry our products online. If you just type in Strauss Brands or Strauss Veal or Free Raised, there's a few sites out there. Allen Brothers is our premier site, and we're very proud of that partnership and relationship with them.
Okay, so they do all the ordering and distribution.
They do the online, but certainly the Whole Foods carries, you know, our products, and, you know, it depends where people are in the United States, but, you know, various regions from, you know, Publix in the South to Bilo to Roundy's in the Midwest and Lunds and Byerly, and just across the country, we just have a lot of fantastic partners that proudly, you know, carry our program.
Now, will you actually see the brand? I mean, I see veal at Whole Foods, but it doesn't say Strauss Brands on it.
Yep. Some of the Whole Foods do, but typically they've been saying now Strauss Pasture-Raised, H.E. Butt, and down in Texas is now carrying our group-raised program, and they're doing a fabulous job with it as well.
Okay,
as their central markets.
Excuse me, Randy. So, for example, in a Whole Foods, it would not just be veal. It would say Strauss Brands veal.
Peter, some of the places do that. Some people have the full branding package. Some people still, some of the, our partners still, you know, brand it under their store brand.
Okay.
On our website, there's a where to buy section that pretty much lists, you know, most of our partners and gives a pretty thorough list. If anyone has any questions of, you know, certain regions, they could just send us an email at info@straussbrands.com, and I'll personally, you know, direct them to a place that in their region that they could pick up our product.
And the spelling is Strauss Brands.
Right, that's correct.
And you sell to a lot of restaurants as well.
Right, restaurants. Yeah. You know, there's some, you know, big, powerful name chefs that, you know, are carrying the products, and, you know, certainly all our food service partners, you know, are out there telling the story. But, and as you mentioned, it's a re-education. I mean, we really appreciate, like, the opportunity to be, you know, on your show today, just to share the fact that it's okay to eat veal again, and, you know what, this is the kind of veal that you can feel good about eating. It's good for you. It's healthy. It's fabulous. It tastes good. But the other good thing is it's very easy to prepare. And if you go, again, to our website, StraussBrands.com, you know, there's a lot of videos on, you know, make sure people pound their veal. People sometimes don't know you got to pound a piece of scallopini. There's simple recipes on there. Some veal item, you know, entrees only take 2 minutes or less to prepare. Peter mentioned osso buco. That's a classic. That's a fantastic savory dish. That takes a little longer to prepare. So all those recipes are on our website so people can just, you know, take a look and easily prepare a veal and dinner for their friends and family, one they can be very proud of.
When you get the pork product going, be sure to let us know. Because,
I promise I will.
Because something needs to be done with the quality of pork you can get in stores, because it's not
because it's not
where it needs to be.
Yeah, well, of course they sold the Nyman Ranch, and it's
right.
The founder is not happy at all.
I understand the standards
that he set up. I mean, that's another. Because you're still there and guiding the principles of your business, but if it gets too big, it gets lost.
No, we live and die by our principles. We believe in what's good for the calves is good for the environment. It's good for the people eating. We want it to be good for people's kids. There's so much junk out there that people, you know, these kids these days, you know, there's so much child obesity and diabetes. We're trying to create a product that, you know, fits, you know, a across generations. You know, there's a lot of gluten allergies out there, so some of our further fabricated hot dogs and raviolis and all sorts of great things, ultimately they're all going to be under our free-raise label. That's the gold standard. It's one that, you know, people are going to, you know, just understand that this is a movement. It's about taking care of yourself and the environment and your health.
Well, listeners, if you all of a sudden got really excited about veal and you want a particularly interesting recipe, which I found in a butcher's cookbook of all things, we had them the other day. We had veal burgers with some very special seasonings. If you're interested in getting that recipe, just send us a note through all the ways you can contact us on the Menu Radio. And thank you so much, Randy, for joining us on the program today.
Peter, thank you, Ann. Thank you so much.
And
I
Randy,
so much appreciate
you sound so pleased with where you are with this. I mean, it's such satisfaction you're experiencing. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. We're proud of it, and we're proud of all the good things that can come out of this and hopefully improve animal welfare for everyone.
Okay, Randy.
Let's go veal.
I missed that. Okay, thank you very much, and let us know about the pork.
Okay, have a great day, everyone.
Thank you, Randy.
Thank you.
Bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. As we know, you ask any chef what is his or her most important tool, and it is the knife. And we're always finding new knives. These we're going to be talking about are beautiful examples. And it's called New West Knives, new to us, too, and it is from the West.
From Jackson Hole, Wyoming, a very unusual place from which to make knives, but our guest explained how he got into the business. They've been in the business a long time, and they make a whole lot of knives. And then, after that, though, the chef's best friend is not just a knife. The chef's best friend is a sharp knife. So we're pairing New West knives with Chef's Choice knife sharpeners and a variety of other products as well. And the president of that company joined us to explain how that product fits in. So we're going to put these two segments back to back for you. So knives and how to sharpen them.
We're talking now to a bladesmith of sorts. You're going to tell us all about it, Corey Milligan in Jackson Hole. New West Knife Works. Now that's your company, and you make knives, and they're beautiful knives. Tell us a little bit of the story. How did you end up there? Are you from there? How did you start making knives?
I grew up in Columbus, Ohio, and moved to Jackson Hole, Wyoming when I finished college. When I graduated, I knew that I wanted to live in the mountains, and I had a geology and a geography professor that said that Jackson Hole was the most beautiful place I'd ever been, and I hadn't been anywhere, so I moved out here, and I've been here for 20 years.
And it's certainly a lot more beautiful than Columbus, Ohio.
It is. Don't tell my mom.
You
that.
Don't tell my cousins that.
they would claim that Columbus is beautiful. That means they've never been to Jackson Hole. The only thing I remember about Jackson Hole that sticks vividly in my mind is when your plane takes off, it looks like it's going to run into the Grand Tetons.
That's right.
I mean, it just looks like you couldn't possibly make it up and over this mountain.
You know, I keep trying to remember where I first heard about New West Knife Works. And I can't remember where it was. Where might it have been, do you suppose?
Yeah, because they really have striking appearance, I get a lot of editorial coverage in magazines. So I've been in all kind of the big food magazines.
Yeah, most likely that was it.
Cause, yeah,
cause
probably.
Because we see all of those and we look through them, not I wouldn't say terribly carefully, but we're always looking for exciting new tools in the kitchen, just as we're looking for exciting new foods and wines and new restaurants. So we must have come across that, I think. But this is not exactly something that you grow up wanting to be, I don't guess, as a bladesmith. So you got to Jackson Hole, but how then this choice of product?
So I was living in Jackson Hole for many years. This is a tourist town, so you end up doing different jobs at different times. I was a whitewater rafting guide, and for many winters I worked by day skiing at the Jackson Hole Mountain Resort and at night working in kitchens. And I had a friend that I grew up with who was really had a fine art background, and he started messing around with making knives as kind of art objects, and then we started working together because I'd worked in kitchens a lot to make the knives more of a functional tool. And so I really liked the design and appearance part. I was always excited about seeing if we could make a better tool. And so we started messing around with it and really had instantly had success selling them at fine art and craft shows. And that's how we built the business for 10 years. He and I both would travel around doing fine art shows. If you live in a city that has a good art show, we were probably there at one point or another. And it's really grown up from that.
So this was more than 10 years ago.
Yeah, this was about 1996, I think, is when we first started doing it.
Oh, boy. You're ahead of your time.
So some of the sculpting on the blade part, some of that's for style and some of that's for function?
Well, I really think of there's a little style in the blade part, but the art part started as those colored handles that you see in the fusion wood knives.
Good.
And another big signature thing that we did a lot of is make knife sets. So we'd make a knife block that was kind of a sculpture by the time you put all the knives in it.
Yeah, I'm looking at a picture of that.
Okay.
Really lovely. Yeah, I'd like to see that in my counter.
But let's not forget the purpose of a knife, right? So it's not just to look handsome. It's to actually cut things, and we have two. Which ones do we have? We have a small knife, which is very versatile, a little chopper. Mm-hmm. And then we have a bigger one that has a rounded blade. What do you call that one?
And then we have a chopper and a paring knife.
Oh, and so that one's a chopper, the one that has a sort of a roundish appearance on
right. Isn't that what we have, the duo set?
Gosh, I should have looked that up before you...
I'm pretty sure that's true.
Is the blade on the bigger one like 5.5-6 inches long, or is it like a Santoku shape?
I think it's more like that.
It's not Santoku.
No, it's rounded. Yeah. Santoku has a sort of a hook on the top. Yeah. The one you sent is a hook on the top, but the blade itself is also curved.
Yeah, so I'm thinking that you have a chopper and a paring knife.
That's what I think it is. That's what they said, actually.
And they're just incredibly useful. They went into use immediately.
Oh,
and our previous favorite knives are now sticking on the magnetized bar and waiting for them to become favorite again, which is probably not going to happen.
Who are your customers? Who do you do these for? I mean, you're past the arts and crafts fair stage.
Right. So our original customer was folks that would buy the knives at fine art and craft shows. I would say half of them bought them because they were beautiful art pieces and half of them bought them because they like a good knife. And a real important part about doing art shows for all those years is it got us focused on making knives for the home user as much as for the chef. So we make a lot of those kind of smaller, mid-size chef all-around utility knives, like the chopper that you have, because there's so many folks that, you know, they go to the kitchen store and the person there tells them, you know, you need to buy an 8-inch chef and a paring knife. Well, they do what they're told and buy the 8-inch chef, but because they don't have any real training, it sits in their knife block and they never use it because they're scared of it. So we always try to have that kind of middle-sized, big enough to be functional, but not so big that it's scary for all those folks who just don't really like a chef knife. And then because of my cooking background, I like to use a big knife, and I want to make sure that we have that for our customers as well.
So you have some of those as well?
Oh, yeah. So we have my favorite knife that we make is a 9-inch chef knife. It's kind of in between that traditional 8 and 10-inch size. We have another 8-inch chef knife, a couple Santokus. So those are great kind of bigger size knives. And so today my customer is the professional chef, the avid home cook. And then because the knives are beautiful, we still sell quite a few to people, you know, especially when we make the knife block sets. Sad to say, I know that I have beautiful, very expensive knife sets that are sculptures. I don't think people even ever take the knives out of the slot.
Now, how do people get them? You have a website where people can locate a store to buy them?
Well, really, my main focus as a business is direct on the Internet.
Oh, okay. All right.
We sell to a few stores, and we've actually been growing a lot over the past couple years in terms of production and sales. And so we're really just kind of getting started in selling to more of the wholesale retail stores. I've gotten calls for years from folks like Williams-Sonoma and Bed Bath & Beyond, but we never had the production capacity and really for a lot of the time the interest in trying to tackle quite that.
Right. So right now, if people want one, or they want to find out more, the website is?
NewWestKnifeWorks.com. So same as our business name, www.newwestknifeworks.com.
Well, I think based on our experience, sweetheart, since we had these wonderful objects in the kitchen, we haven't picked up a different knife. And we'll be chopping something with it tonight. Maybe we'll even chop the asparagus with our New West knife instead of breaking it off with our fingers.
I'm blushing on the other end of the line.
Just because it's so much. It's so nice to have something new and interesting, and also, after all, the most important thing about a knife that's really sharp. And
yeah, I'd love to give you a little comment about, besides them being pretty, what makes them special. And
fire away, please. Absolutely.
Just ask you what you really want to promote with your knives. Yeah. Do that.
So obviously, they are striking in appearance, and like I said, a lot of folks buy them the first time because they're beautiful, but what gives us such a great return business is my biggest focus is that first we have to make the best possible tool, and then we add kind of the design and appearance part after that. And when it comes to making a knife, there are lots of parts of it, but, you know, it's the two big things are what's the steel that it's made out of, and then how is it ground or fabricated to make it work well. And something that I've always done in terms of deciding on what steel I want to use is my philosophy on what the priorities are. There's literally hundreds of different kinds of steel that you can use to make a knife out of, and really, like, think of cooking. Your recipe on what ingredients you put into the steel determines how it comes out. And more of one thing makes one way it functions work one way, and then more of another thing makes it function another way, and there's kind of opposites. For example, the better a knife holds its edge in general, the more brittle it is. So the more likely it is to break if you try to cut a real thick bone or something like that, or chip the edge.
Of course, that's the problem with the ceramic knives.
Yeah, that's what I always hear from folks is, oh, it's a great knife.
It is, except
it never gets dull, except 2 years after I owned it, I dropped it on the floor and it broke.
Exactly.
That's exactly what happened to our Kyocera knife. Anyway.
And the other problem is it's so brittle with those knives is they can't even really make a big knife. You know, I don't think they make it.
So anyway, you dealt with that compromise that you just mentioned.
Yeah, and so for me, there's really three qualities in a knife that are give and take. It's edge holding, it's sharpenability, and stain resistance.
Okay, see, the last one eliminates. My favorite knife of all times that is the oldest I have is an old-fashioned carbon steel chef's knife.
Yep.
Which rusts.
Yeah, it sure looks.
But
sure.
I love it.
It's really sharp, but it sure looks ugly.
Right. And I know that is for folks who like to use a knife all the time and sharpen it. That's what I hear time and again is I love that old carbon steel knife. And this steel that we use for our knives is the closest that I've found to that kind of performance in terms of, most importantly, how you can sharpen it and keep it sharp, but also edge holding while it still has a stainless rating and is stain resistant. That being said, one sacrifice that we've made is, even though this is a stainless steel in our knives, it is slightly less stain resistant than, like, say, a German knife.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, listen,
and I feel like, go ahead.
What a very thoughtful man you are. It's a most unusual career that you have set out on, and I'm guessing you're going to continue down this pathway. So if you have some kind of breakthrough in knifing, won't you be sure to let us know?
Oh, I will.
How many knives do you have?
How many different styles?
Yes.
Off the top of my head, we have two different lines. One is with the colored handle that we call fusion wood knife, and then the other one is made, the main feature is the blades are Damascus steel, and between the two, I think we have about 50.
Well, I wish you a lot of luck. I mean, this is, it's not just luck, it's hard work. But you've certainly been, now would you please keep emailing me, because I don't have anybody else that greets me as Howdy.
I'm sure that my Ohio parents roll their eyes every time they hear me say that. But, you know, everybody wants to move out west and become a cowboy, don't they?
I guess so. I've been interviewing lots of cowboys, including real ones in the field, like herding cattle and stuff. I didn't realize they existed, but I'm learning a lot. So, Corey, thank you so much, and let us hear from you time and again.
You got it.
Okay, Corey.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Bye-bye. It's good to hear your voice, Sam Weiner of Edgecraft Corp. Tell us a little bit about your company.
I'll be happy to. It just so happens that we're celebrating our 25th anniversary this year, which we're quite pleased about. The company got started about 25 years ago when the founder, Dan Friel Sr., had some difficulties carving a turkey for a Thanksgiving party that he was throwing. And he really butchered it up and was embarrassed by it, and the next day decided he was going to go out and find a good sharpener to sharpen up this carving set that his wife had given him.
And he couldn't find one.
And he couldn't find a good sharpener. He bought just about every sharpener he could get his hands on and couldn't find one. So being an engineer, he said, the heck with it, I'm going to design my own. And he went down his basement and went through about a dozen different prototypes and finally emerged with what turned out to be our first electric sharpener, the Model 100, which incidentally we're still selling quite successfully.
Well, I think we have an old one that needed to be replaced, so we're relieved that a replacement came along. It's funny you should talk about carving a turkey, because one of my uncles growing up, we used to go to their house after my grandfather died. We used to go there on Christmas Day. We went to Auntie Margaret and Uncle John's because she was the oldest of the children, so she got the Christmas Day tradition. But my grandfather was always very accomplished, using a steel to sharpen the knife and then carving the turkey. And Uncle John used to carve his turkey in the kitchen.
And did people watch it?
That's why he went in the kitchen. no one would see it.
I became the designated turkey carver amongst our family and friends because, you know, I do it so often in demonstrations and so on.
Oh, yeah.
And it's become a spectator sport. No matter how often I do it, people just gather around and they're intrigued by the fact that I can, you know, carve up this turkey and just remove all the great meats and put them out on a platter. It's a wonderful thing to do, and I'm trying to teach somebody else to take my place, but nobody's stepping up.
Now, do you do it the way they suggest, which is to remove the breast?
I actually do it in a more traditional way. I remove the wings, leaving a turkey serve on its back, and that still allows it to be stable. And then I do a horizontal cut just below the breast. And then I do vertical cuts to get all the white meat, nice clean slices, and I lay those out on a platter, and then I start working on the dark meat.
The most important thing to remember is the key to successful carving is a sharp knife.
Exactly.
And the key to a sharp knife is something to make sure it's not only sharp, but it's honed to the right angle. So I think I might have set you up there.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. You know, it's ironic because there's a misconception amongst people that if you buy a good enough knife, you'll never have to sharpen it. And that's the furthest from the truth. The reality is that factory edge, the edge that's put on by the factory, only lasts the first few times that you use that knife. And after those first few times, what's called the factory edge is gone. And then you have to worry about, what am I going to do for the remaining 99.9% of the life of this knife? How am I going to maintain it? Because no matter how much you've paid for it, if it's dull, it's simply not going to be able to do its job. And it's a shame because people spend sometimes hundreds or thousands of dollars getting equipped with very fine knives, but don't know how to maintain the edge.
Well, now, do you, most recommendations included that, what is that rod thing?
Yeah, butcher steel.
Yeah,
steel.
Yeah,
that's what my grandfather used to use.
Yeah, my father was a butcher, and he knew how to use it, and the customers would bring in all their dull knives and ask him to steel them for him. But we realized that early on that it's an impossible task. Nobody really knows how to use a steel properly unless you're somebody like my dad. And people feel guilty. They think it's their fault. It isn't. It's an impossible thing to do because you have to maintain a precise angle, which is around 20 degrees. And we simply don't have robotic wrists. You know, we as human beings can't move our hands and maintain a precise angle. So unless you have the intuitive skill that you've developed over many years, the reality is you're put up to a task which is really impossible.
Well,
and
I'm glad to hear that because I've always felt inadequate that I can't use that steel.
No, it's...
I welcomed your chef. Choice.
Yeah, I think it's a disservice that knife companies do to their customers by urging them to use it.
You know, we've interviewed Wusthof, and they sell their knife sets with a steel.
Well, the reason they do that is because the knife gets messed up much quicker, and you have to buy a new one.
Yeah,
I mean, our son Adam has one.
You're absolutely right.
This is disposable society. So anyway, you said founder David Friel actually invented this sharpener.
That's right.
It was the first one in the world, huh?
Yes, well, the first one that was high-tech, there were other, you know, there are things like bench grinders were around or the sharpeners on the back of can openers, which were totally inadequate.
Oh,
in fact, they did hurt the knife. But when he invented a sharpener, he basically introduced three key technologies. He decided, after testing many abrasives, he decided to use 100% diamond abrasives. And to this day, that's what we use in our sharpeners. And diamonds have some very unique characteristics which make them make them very suitable for knives. And then the second thing he introduced on that sharpener was guides, which alludes to exactly and what you were mentioning.
Sam,
because
Sam,
nobody knows how to maintain the right angle.
Sam?
Yes?
I just wanted to clarify. This was the first ever of this kind of a sharpener that had the set angle, and that this one product launched an entire corporation?
It sure did. We now have hundreds of different sharpeners, and we've expanded the corporation beyond that, where we also market meat slicers for the home, and waffle makers, and electric tea kettles, and a whole lot of other products. So, this one sharpener spawned the whole corporation.
The amazing thing, I think, is that this is an American enterprise, right? You make the products in Avondale, Pennsylvania.
That's right. About 80% of what we sell is made right here in our factory in Avondale, Pennsylvania.
A lot of people say in the United States you can't make products like that anymore. They're all made in China and other places where labor is cheaper. So let's just hear it for a corporation that had a really great idea and is still doing it the same way.
Yeah, and it can be done. It takes dedication and it takes a lot of creativity. All of our sharpeners have patents on them, and we try to stay ahead of whatever competition may be coming out of China. Of course, from a cost point of view, there's a great advantage to Chinese-made goods.
But what I was wondering, how you could compete in that market.
It's based on the quality and the service we deliver, and we have a great following particularly amongst gourmet cooks.
And chefs.
And chefs.
I get a very famous chef. I was writing his cookbook with him, and I asked him what he used at home to sharpen his knives, and of course it was yours.
I don't know which model, which is the other question.
You also keep on inventing new things, and we have another new thing that we need to talk about as well, having done knife sharpening.
Well, now I wanted to ask how does somebody, because I had a hard time figuring out, you have so many sharpeners. How many sharpeners do you have?
Well, it's in the hundreds, because we have them not only for the U.S., we now sell our products in about 60 countries throughout the world, and you know, knives tend to be a little different as you move around the world.
Okay.
So, but the easiest thing is to go to our website at www.chefschoice.com or edgecraft.com, and we have a little chart that you can go through, and people can sort of check off the items that they're interested in, and it tells them which sharpener is best suited for them. Or they can call our 800 number. We're unique in that people do answer our phones, and if you have a question or you want to be guided as to which sharpener you want to buy, just call our 800 number, 1-800-342-3255, and our operators are trained. They'll be able to help you.
Oh, wonderful.
Now, can you also find where the product's stocked as well on the website?
And you can also, at that point, ask the person answering the phone for a location, and they'll ask you for your zip code, and then they'll give you a number of stores around that zip code area that you can go that sell our product.
Now, the other thing you were kind enough to send us is something that no home in England is without. It's an electric kettle, but it's an electric kettle with a difference, because it's cordless, but it has a cord. You're gonna have to explain that one.
it's probably a joke for Jay Leno on a nightly show. But the cord is part of the base, and the kettle itself is connected to that base. So after the water boils or heats up to the temperature you desire, you can lift it off that base and carry it anywhere you want without having to worry about a cord that drags along.
Oh, I see. So the cord is built into the base. It doesn't plug into the kettle.
Correctly, yes.
Oh, okay.
And that kettle is portable. And being from England, I'm sure you appreciate the importance of having water at the right temperature when you're steeping your tea. To get the best taste and aroma from tea, there's three things that you got to remember. You got to have the water at the right temperature. You have to put in the recommended amount of tea, and you have to control the steeping time. And, once the water's in contact with the tea. And in today's world, teas, even in the United States, there's so many varieties of tea now available. And particularly the young people are very much into enjoying all the various specialty teas. And when you are drinking either the unfermented teas like the green teas or the semi-fermented teas like the oolongs, or the black teas, each one, to get the maximum benefit from it, the best taste and aroma from it, you have to steep it at the right temperature. And that's where this kettle comes in, because it can bring the water to the exact temperature that you desire.
Yeah, it says
and
right
it'll
there.
Hold it there.
Yeah, it says right on the carafe, or whatever you call it, that you set it according to the type of tea you're using.
And that of course, so long as the container tells you what temperature you want it to be at.
Well, it's fortunate that we did both in the instruction manual. There's a little chart that tells you.
So you have it in there.
What tea, what temperature to use, and also the box itself gives you at least a temperature range for the various teas. So we try to make it easy for people, but you know, the young people have become very educated. My son, who's working in an office environment, was one of our first customers.
Uh-huh.
He drinks only tea. He doesn't drink coffee, and he's traveled around the world, so he knows about the green teas and the white teas and the jasmines, and he knows that they have to be steeped at the right temperature. And as soon as I told him about this new temperature control kettle that we were launching, he said, "You got to buy me one." So it was one of his birthday presents.
Well, that was easy. Huh? You just took one off the shelf and put a nickel in the cash register, and away you went.
That's right.
Now, do you think that one of these days every American home will have an electric kettle? I mean, today very few do.
It's true, you know, but it's still an underdeveloped market in the U.S., but more and more people are coming in and supplying tea kettles. We were one of the first ones in the United States. I know for the U.K. and parts of Europe, it's old hat. But when we got into the electric tea kettle business over here, you could hardly find one. They just weren't around. Most people are using the stovetop kettles. And when we started looking into this electric kettle category, we realized just what a great advantage it was. Not too many people know, for example, that if you're really concerned about conserving energy, to boil water in one of these tea kettles takes about half the energy of doing it on a stove.
Oh, yes, no, I'm sure it does. It's also quicker.
It's faster.
Yeah.
And it's more convenient.
I must say it was a life-changing experience for me to understand that I didn't have to get out of a little pot and fill it with water, a little saucepan.
Yeah, the interesting thing is the one that's about to be replaced actually came from a tea company. Came from somebody who produced tea, and they wanted to make sure that you had the right device for making it, and so they sold them as well as their teas, and I think you're onto things now. Sam, you're always ahead, and I know you wouldn't be willing to give any secrets away, but what sort of next do you think that's coming down the pipe for small electrical appliances like you make?
Well, if I told you, I may have to kill you.
I understand.
It's a top secret, but the one thing that we always focus on is that regardless of what product we launch on the market, we want to make sure that it's the best available. And that's really what's carried this company. And, you know, our motto is the passion to create the world's best. We're hoping that if people want to go out, buy any kitchen appliance, that they keep our brand and name the Chef's Choice brand, because that's really our passion. And we do want to make sure that we have a unique product, and it's a long-lasting product, and one that portrays the quality that we want to put into these products. We have launched some new products in the last year or so, for example, an electric egg cooker. Most people sort of look at us when we said an electric egg cooker, how hard can it be to cook an egg?
Oh, no, that sounds like a great idea. I wish I had known about that.
I'd have
tested that one.
It's a wonderful thing, because when we talk to lots of chefs, they said one of the most common questions they get is, how do I hard boil an egg correctly? And there's so many ways of doing it, but what this egg cooker does it by steam. It has a timer on it, and it cooks it precisely at the right temperature and also at the right amount of time, so you get a perfectly hard-boiled egg out of it. And you can, it has some wonderful features. You can make poached eggs in it, and you can, in the same batch of eggs, you can make some soft-boiled, some hard-boiled, some medium-boiled.
Holy Moses,
and,
that's incredible.
And it's very simple to use. And until you taste an egg that's properly hard-boiled, you just can't believe the difference between the rubbery type eggs that I've been accustomed to, and they were typically overcooked.
Well, Sam, if the UPS man knocks on my door in the next couple of weeks with an egg cook with an egg cooker in there. I will not be surprised. I thank you so much for talking about it. And when you get another top secret invention about to go public, I hope you'll announce it early on the Menu Radio. It was just a pleasure to have you on the program.
I was going to say, actually, even if I didn't like your products, which I absolutely do, I love your products because they are quality, I'd buy them anyhow because you're such a nice man.
Well, it was a sheer pleasure for me to talk to you guys, and best of luck with your program. It's a wonderful program, and I know lots of people throughout the world enjoy it.
Well, you keep up the great work. It's good to know that Yankee ingenuity is still alive and well in southeastern Pennsylvania.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sam. Bye-bye.
So long.
And with this meaty discussion under our belt, it's time to pause again for a short commercial break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Here we are again, and we're going to be talking to a man who's never short of scintillating insights, comments, and has a wonderful new book out called Simply Pig.
So Jimmy Villas is a bit of an icon.
I call him Jim.
And after you've listened to what he has to say, you'll understand why.
Pig sounds like a rather ungracious title for a book.
Well, it's not the title I wanted.
It's not the title you wanted. What?
The title I wanted was Southern Pig.
Southern Pig, okay.
And, of course, they all said, oh, no, we can't do that. That's politically incorrect. And I just had a fit. Imagine we fought it and we couldn't win. And so now we have the title Pig, and then in very small type, King of the Southern Table, which nobody can sort of see. And so everyone sort of thinks the book is just on Pig. And it really is on Southern. Is it ever?
Yeah. Go ahead, explain.
Well, the concept is what's totally different. I mean, Peter's pig is our very sustenance and has been for 300 years. And unlike the rest of the, I just got back from Carolina, and I'm always reminded of that when I go home. I mean, unlike the rest of the country, you go to any market anywhere else, and you'll find some loins, and you'll find pork chops and ribs and that sort of thing. You go into a southern market. Like, I just went into God knows how many down there. The reason I went down there, as a matter of fact, was because I was raised on what is called whole hog sausage. And I have not had any whole hog sausage in years. And I spent a year researching this, trying to find out if anybody was still making whole hog sausage. And I found some old farmer in Wadesboro was. And so I went down there, and I found it. I got it, and I brought back 4 pounds.
That's only 4 pounds, but that would barely last a week.
I don't have any room.
Because
I also had to bring back their bacon, and I had to bring back some country ham.
We didn't mention the fact that we're talking to Jim Villas, who is...
We forgot that, didn't we?
Yeah, we didn't mention that. How do you describe yourself? In addition to being an author, you're also...
Hungry
and long-lasting figure in the culinary field here.
I've been around a pretty long time, and as I say, I was from the very beginning with town. I was a town and country for 27 years.
I forgot to mention that.
As the food line editor. And
right.
We began there on this campaign of mine, you know, with American cooking when it was very unfashionable. And my very first book was called American Taste. And I've tried to follow that through all the way, and I still, you know, champion, you know, our cooking more than anything else except maybe French. So, you know, I also write novels, but food is just, you know, it's been the major part of my life for the past 40 years.
Exactly. Tell us, you started to mention about how you were the first to focus on California, to recognize that this was American cuisine.
Well, I didn't go out there for food.
No, but you also
even though when
did
I went
the
for
wine.
Food, it was awfully damn good food.
Yeah.
But I had heard about, you know, in those days, in the 70s, it was inconceivable. I mean, if you wanted to drink fine wine, you drank French wine or Italian wine.
Right.
And I heard about these Joe Whites and a lot of others, you know, the Mondavis and so forth, producing some very, very good wine. Well, I didn't believe it. Nobody believed. But I went out there, and these 12 guys were really producing some premium wines. And I think we published probably the very first article in Town and Country on this being the verve of the future, which, of course, it's now. It goes without saying that our wines compete with the California wines compete with any wines in the world.
Yeah, but let's get. Should we return to the subject? Well, we can't let this picture go in the back of the book.
I didn't finish about my trip to the South Indies.
Oh, go ahead.
You go into markets down there as compared to up here anywhere else in the country, and you find ears, you find feet, you find snouts, you find tails. In other words, we always laugh saying that in the South we eat everything of the pig except the oink.
Right.
And we do. And there's not a piece of the pig that has not been the very staple for Southerners, you know, for centuries.
Right.
And so I wanted to do this book, you know, to show there's a great deal more to the hog and the pig than what most people see in the supermarket. And I'm trying to get people, for example, instead of always roasting or always baking a loin of pork, you know, to try a shoulder. Or above all, instead of baking a ham, a regular smoked ham, which is awfully good, I love them, but why not a fresh ham? Now, a Southerner always likes a fresh ham better than a regular ham.
Uh-huh.
It's a juicier, it's a better cut of meat.
Yeah, I like it too.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And then eventually, you know, try to get people to fry some pig ears. They are wonderful.
I love them. They've started emerging as a popular bar food now.
Yeah, we went.
Well,
to
they are. People still think they're only fed to dogs.
No, we went to
a huge business. I mean, pig ears for dogs are a huge business. You know.
Oh, because it's sort of chewy, I guess. But we went to this restaurant called Bar something or like that, not Bar Baloo, but it was a name somewhat similar to that in New York. And the chef who was South African, no, he was Dutch, and he made pig's ears as a bar snack.
That's very rare.
But he cooked them for a very long time and then cut them into pieces and then refried them and then presented them as a bar snack. And they were quite delicious.
Really, yeah.
That's it. Well, you really need to boil them first. But it's like okra. You know, we're always trying to convert people to okra, and I learned years ago with the Yankees, you know, they will not eat okra and tomatoes because they think it's slimy. So what you do is you give them fried okra. Well, the same with pig. What you do is pig ears. Once you boil the hell out of them, you know, then fry them up, and people will eat them. They do love them then.
We had just had some weird part of a pig. What was that? It was some innards.
A weird part of a pig?
Yeah, some innard.
I don't know. We believe in eating the whole animal too. We're like Fergus Henderson, and we're like Paul Kahan of Blackbird in Chicago. Yeah. And
well, the difference, though, Peter, is we've been doing that for centuries.
Yeah, this is.
I mean, Fergus began this around 15 years ago in London, you know, in England.
There you go.
Well, but we've been doing it. It's just like all this hullabaloo about organic food and free-range chickens. My God, I was raised on nothing but free-range chickens. Not only free-range chickens, my neighbor killed them.
Yeah.
This is one of the first things I learned was how to wring the neck of a chicken.
Well, you had to learn how to catch them first, I guess, right?
Right. But, I mean, I remember all of that, these little farmers coming up to our door with little trucks and scales, and I didn't eat any crappy food. I didn't eat processed food or anything.
Now, what take us inside the covers, Jim, of this?
Pardon me?
Take us inside the cover of your book and give us talk to us about some of your favorite recipes that are in.
Oh, boy, that's difficult. But I can, well, I cover, there's no category I don't cover. I go from appetizers all the way through breads to show what can be done with pork. And I would say the more unusual recipes in there that they'll find that never heard of before, for example, is an appetizer or some eat as a breakfast, is called hobotee, H-O-B-O-T-E-E, which is a wonderful curried meat custard that you find out in Charleston, South Carolina. I introduce them, I hope, you know, to something like in the soup chapter, to country ham and corn chowder. Then if you love corn chowder, well, boy, you put some good Southern country ham in that, and it's 10 times even better. I've tried to introduce them to Frogmore stew,
which, again,
is down in the low country, which is a very rough and ready stew of sausage links and corn and shrimp and potatoes that you eat in a rough and ready manner. I've tried to introduce them to Indian pork chili that I learned about when I went up to Cherokee Reservation.
Oh, I just saw that recipe in here.
Yeah, the Indians don't use beef. They use pork for that. Why? Because it's such a long story. You see, Hernando de Soto introduced 13 pigs into this country in Tampa, Florida, in the middle part of the 16th century. And we learned immediately in the South that those pigs were so adaptable, so cheap to raise, and above all, lent themselves to everything that be done to meat. in the way of curing, aging, preserving, and so forth. And by the way, those pigs, those feral pigs, were off the coast of North Carolina on an island of something called Ossabo Balboa pigs. O-S-S-O, I talk about it in the book. Now, you tell me, those are the descendants of those original pigs. They're wild pigs.
Well, is that the what Sean Brock is experimenting with? He's calling this new breed, he's a pig. He's calling
I don't think so, because this is not Brock a new breed. This is the original breed.
No, but I meant he referred to that in his name. I wondered where he got this name, which has his name first, Brock, but then the original breed is tacked onto that name.
I don't know.
Yeah, just actually.
I don't know. But then, to go on with the book, as far as something like pork chops are concerned, sure, there's nothing like a good fried pork chop, but why not stuff it with blue cheese and mushrooms?
Wow.
Why not make them, I love them with a sticky, peachy glaze, for example. I like them smothered with raisins and braised in port gravy, made with port wine, you know.
Yeah, and you're so slim. I mean, it's just...
Oh, not really.
Was a good photo then.
And I go on. I mean, what we do with pies and loaves, for example, is really just so exciting. You haven't lived until you have eaten a meatloaf that is totally encased in bacon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you love bacon. The only thing I remember about the bacon book is you said you shouldn't be too greedy and you shouldn't eat as much. You shouldn't eat so much at once. I always feel guilty when I make more than three rations at a time.
Well, that's all you need is three rations. I had three this morning, as a matter of fact.
Yeah,
and people scream and holler about bacon. Oh, it's fattening, it's got cholesterol. I get very, very impatient because I just want to call them pigs. They're gluttons. I mean, I know people eat a quarter of a pound of bacon. Well, they deserve what they get. And it's like all of Americans. We overeat, period. We are gluttons.
Oh, yeah,
we
no
are
question.
Compulsive eaters. I have a relative today that's getting ready to undergo, he weighs 300 pounds, is undergo the knife to have a bariatric surgery. There's no excuse in that.
Oh, no. And then my hairdresser did that, too.
We totally agree with you. We must not get on that, though. We might have some listeners who are, you know, shall we say, of a larger size, and we certainly don't want to upset them.
Well, maybe they ought to be upset.
because
it's so, listen, Peter, I eat all day long. I just had my gallbladder out, and so now I can really eat anything whatsoever I want to. My mother just died this year at the age of 93, and my mother ate country ham and sausage and bacon every morning of her life and drank Jack Daniels every night of her life. And I buried her with a flask, her pocketbook flask of Jack Daniels in the coffin.
I should think, she might need a cocktail on the way upstairs.
Yeah, exactly. People say, "Was and I said, of course there was liquor in there. It was half full of Jack Daniels.
Only half full, though.
Only half
well,
full.
Well, we had a friend who...
But my mother, for example, she ate like that her whole life. My mother was never overweight.
Yeah, but it's genes, too. Come on.
Oh, gene has a lot. Gene has everything to do with everything, I think.
Yeah. So, anyhow, what's the geographical scope of this?
The whole South.
Okay. Because I just came across some Alabama stuff.
Well, I can say, you know, we go from Maryland to Arkansas back up to, say, West Virginia. Not too much in West Virginia. They got some good food over there, but it's just not very varied. But, boy, you get down there in Mississippi and, the Carolinas and...
Kentucky. How about Kentucky, huh?
And Kentucky, my God. They turn out hams that are as good or better than ours in the mountains of North Carolina.
Well, who's at Broadbent? Broadbent has a country ham that's auctioned off every year at the county fair.
Oh, yeah,
right.
but he bought that business, and he's a bit commercial. Benton, Jim, is it?
No, it's Broadbent.
No, you're not. I know the Broadbent Ham Company, and I mean, that's where we buy our bacon from, and it's really very good. The guy is much more famous as the one that John Besh and all those other guys like.
Oh,
his name is His name is Benton, you know him? Alan Benton,
yes,
I think.
Benton, I do. He's very good hams.
Yeah.
But they also do bacon.
Yes, yep.
Benton does very good bacon. But as you learn from the bacon book, though, I mean, we've got producers all over the country now doing wonderful artisan
bacon. Oh, yeah,
bacon.
Absolutely.
And what worries me are the country hams. That is my big problem today.
You're afraid they're going to disappear?
I certainly do.
Well, but I've started to mention that people bid like five figures for these hams at the county fairs. It's, I guess, tax deductible, but...
Yeah, we have friends who are from... She's from Paducah, Kentucky, I think?
No,
it's somewhere near Paducah. Is it Cairo, Kentucky, or something like that?
No.
Well, boy, they produce good hams over there.
Yeah, she gets one shipped up from her hometown a couple of times a year.
We've got to think of the name of this town, because Marcy will kill us.
See, that's the problem, though, is that... That's the problem, is that so few of those producers are shipping because they simply will not submit to federal inspection.
Right. But
because the feds want to come in there and change the whole formula. That's what happened to my man up in Glendale Springs, North Carolina. Is if you want that ham, you got to get in the car and go get it.
Well, I think that Marcy Sam might be Samsonite. It's really funny. We were in Paso Robles, and they were talking about the first Syrah clones that were introduced into Paso Robles by Gary Eboli, and they referred to as the Samsonite clone.
Oh dear!
Because it traveled in a suitcase.
Right.
Kentucky scramble.
I can delete that. Oh, that last segment, since you were musing rather than talking into the microphone.
I just can't get over the fact that I can't remember the name of Marcy's hometown. It's a funny pronunciation of a French...
So what page are you on now, Miss Haig?
I'm looking at Kentucky Scramble.
Ooh, that sounds fabulous.
Oh, that's a classic dish.
Go ahead, fill us in. What's Kentucky Scramble?
Well, you can put anything in Kentucky Scramble you want, starting with bacon. But if you really want a good Kentucky scramble, you know, you put something like jowls in there. Peter, I think, you know, now is... I remember the day in which no one would touch a pig belly, which is where the bacon's cut from. Today, pig belly is in all the most fashionable restaurants of this country.
Oh, I know it is, yes.
And I figure, my guess is the next thing they're going to snatch on to, finally, are probably pig jowls, which are wonderful. They're very sweet.
Guanciale.
Yeah, that's a big thing. It's a big thing in Italy. And
guanciale is the same. Italians have been doing it for 500 years.
Yeah, exactly.
But only Southerners have, you know, known
Cadiz,
about
Cadiz. Cadiz, Kentucky.
Goodness for that.
How do you spell Cadiz?
C-A-D-I-Z.
Cadiz.
It's pronounced by the locals or natives. It's pronounced Cadiz.
It's Cadiz. Cadiz. Yeah, I do know Cadiz. That. Well, very well. That's a wonderful... Now been there for years and years and years.
Lots of famous people, talented people came there. Authors and stuff.
You're giving me an editor nightmare. I don't know what I'm going to do with this part of the conversation.
I didn't know that, but they do have a country place that's been there for years.
That's the one that our friend buys from.
Yeah, that's the one that was bought out by somebody else, yeah.
Was it?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Well, my connection with that was there's a wonderful... restaurant in Lexington, Kentucky called the Coach House. And it was owned by a Greek man named Stanley Damus. He's now retired in Florida. But he always got his wonderful, and they were wonderful, country hams from Cadiz.
There you go. Well, that must be the... Well, you can be encouraged to make all these things for yourself. I don't know if there's a country ham recipe for how you actually make one for yourself. But there's certainly plenty that you can use some in if you get some. I just have one last question, Jim, before we let you go to chase your dog and stop her from eating the next literary classic.
She's quiet now.
She's quiet. One of the challenges for people who are not in the South is where do you get these different body parts that you can get from a Southern butcher, but you can't get from a Northern butcher?
Yes, you can get from a Northern butcher,
too. You can, okay.
You certainly can. Just go in any butcher shop, and you tell the butcher, no matter what, New York City, no matter where you are, you just tell the butcher, you know, what you would like, and he'll cut it for you.
Well, okay, so you think that whole hog slaughtering is finding its way back into butcher shops?
I don't think it ever left. I don't, as far as that whole hog concept is concerned, which I'm very sensitive about these days because of my sausage thing, that's what I'm most interested in, is using the whole hog, and just on a routine basis, and I think only in the South did that ever happen, and you're seeing it less and less. But I think what you're talking about, any butcher, yes, they've got, you know, they can cut, I think, almost any cut of meat you want.
Now, just one...
And we are seeing more, because of the Hispanic influence, we are seeing more and more in certain areas of the country, more pig's feet, for example.
Yeah, I was raised in pig's feet.
I was too.
I want to ask you off topic here, as a distinguished magazine writer, what are your thoughts on the closing of Gourmet?
And I don't know. I just don't know. I think it's very, very incredibly sad.
Yeah.
To me, the closing of Gourmet is like us not going all out of our way to save the great luxury line of the United States, which is rusting to death in Philadelphia. It's just a great magazine like Gourmet had to go. But I think it was a victim. It was a victim of... It's a victim of what's happening in this country in the food world, which is not good. Everybody thinks it's so wonderful, and I don't agree.
You mean like what, the internet?
Well, I mean everything in Gourmet got under the last editor. It had to be cutting edge. It had to be trendy. It had to be different. It had to be. The word is cutting edge. They simply forgot their roots there. That Earl McLaughlin developed at Jane Montant. And Gail Zweigenthal and Jay Jacobs and the great figures who launched that magazine. Well, Earl launched that back in 43, I think, during the war. The Plaza Hotel in New York. And I did a lot of writing for Gourmet, and they had a wonderful staff, and they were sober for decades. And then when this last editor came in, she just revamped the entire magazine, and I'm afraid that Gourmet's not the only one.
Oh, no.
The only magazine today that really is being sane, I think, is probably Savo.
Here's a thought on which to close. James Villas, you're a throwback.
Yes, always have been.
And this book's a throwback book, and it's a delicious throwback, and we want to thank you for giving it to the world.
And it's very handsome.
It's also a handsome book, and you're a very handsome fellow. I'm trying to figure out if you're having a contest with Tom Wolfe for being the most elegant Southern gentleman on the planet.
Oh, you mean that Tom?
The guy who wears white.
Because when you say Thomas Wolfe to a Southern, you're talking about the novelist.
No, I'm talking about Tom Wolfe who wears white and yellow suits.
I know. At one point, I knew Tom very well.
I bet you did.
We met at Esquire magazine, as a matter of fact.
Oh, yeah.
And I bet you...
But no, I don't prance around in white suits and white ties.
But you're a sartorial splendor. And
thank you.
And we thank you for that, and we thank you for being a throwback, a curmudgeon, whatever word you enjoy. We hope you'll keep on adding to your titles, and you'll talk to us when the next one comes
out. Thank you so much, Peter. It's really great talking to y'all.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So there you have it, another week of On the Menu Radio, another wonderful show. We hope you enjoyed it and you learned a lot.
Well, we always learn a lot.
We do, and we think that we bring you programs you're interested in too, so we hope you'll come back and join us. Same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.